In this hour on Coast to Coast AM, we're going to go to Bolivia and see what's going on over there. And we'll also talk about elongated skulls and get more of Chris's take on what's going on in Egypt. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Brian, the difference, if any, Tiwanaku and Pumapunku, what's the difference? Is there one?
I think so. I think Pumapunku actually is older, and it's better, much finer work than Tiwanaku, because Pumapunku, unfortunately, we only find possibly 5 or 10% of what originally was there, because the stone was recycled since the time of the first Spanish, and they built buildings in the little village of Tiwanaku and also in La Paz out of it. Chris was saying, the surfaces are perfectly flat. I went there with David Childress, and we had steel rulers that we put on the surface and moved them back and forth, and you couldn't see any daylight. So obviously those were machined, whereas Tiwanaku I find a little bit cruder. So I think Pumapunku is older and more sophisticated.
Why do you think it was built, Brian?
David and I have an agreement that we think that it was built by some mysterious people as some kind of factory for processing ore, because it's so high up in elevation, close to the Andes, where there's a lot of gold and silver and copper, that some mysterious people, I think, built it as some kind of facility to process and then abandoned it. And it was later adopted by a culture who decided to turn it into a temple.
Your thoughts, Chris?
I think the Pumapunku, to me, was probably more like a citadel or a fortress, based on my analysis of the H blocks. It seems to me that there was a definitely a construction purpose for it. As far as the ore smelting plant or processing plant, I haven't really studied that theory too much. I'm not sure if there's any literature on what may have been found as far as slag in the area or, you know, other kind of industrial waste that you would find with such an operation. But the definitely there are many elements there that could go into building a very substantial fortress.
Interesting. Go ahead.
As Brian mentioned, the flat surfaces at Pumapunku are incredible when you consider the time period that we're looking at and the supposed technology that these ancient people had. And it kind of reminds me of when I went into the Serapeum or even into the Second Pyramid in Egypt and actually checked the flatness of the inside of the so-called sarcophagus. And then in the Serapeum, these huge granite boxes with that had such a high level of precision on the inside that they actually scream out technology, machining, very, very special purpose for them. But the flat surface is really, it wasn't common in ancient times, particularly something that is as precise as the blocks that we find at Pumapunku. And also, Brian, there are some at Tiwanaku, some very precise, very flat surfaces at Tiwanaku. So, as far as whether they are contemporaneous, I can't really make that determination, but we do see the similarities. But it's really unusual geometries at Pumapunku that make it stand out. Now, as far as the why you would create a flat surface like that. If you don't have, we didn't start creating flat surfaces like that until there was a need for them. And that need was actually founded in the Industrial Revolution, where we needed flat surfaces in order to create machines that where you would have elements or members that would slide along a surface, and that surface had to be flat, otherwise the product you were making, whether it was on a lathe or on a mill, would not be accurate. So those flat surfaces came in later on in the West, as far as a need for that kind of precision. Puma Punku, there is a series of photographs on my website. It's if you actually click on the link there, Mysteries of Peru and Bolivia Revealed, there is a series of photographs towards the bottom, and it's right below the the laser cut object. And I took a dial indicator, which is an instrument that we use in manufacturing to take comparative measures on a surface plate. And the surface plate is an example of a flat surface that we would use in manufacturing. And we use that to create a datum from which we measure very, very precise manufactured items, such as in the shop I work at, turbine parts, gas turbine parts that go in jet engines and things of that nature, and the tools that actually are created to make them. So this instrument had a resolution of 0.5 tenths of an inch, or 0.5 tenths of an inch, which, you know, if you consider what the academics say about these ancient cultures, such as the Incas, they didn't even have a plumb bob, let alone a surface gauge. And then here I am in Bolivia with a surface gauge and passing it along a block, an ancient block that's thousands of years old, and it's less than 0.5 tenths of an inch. The needle on the gauge only moved. It moved less than 0.5 tenths of an inch. I tried it, but there was another observer, Jay Wakefield, who was along on the trip, and so, you know, he obviously. I mean, I do like to have other people verify my work, and it's always best to have actually somebody do it, because, you know, a lot of times you can say, oh well, you know, you actually controlled the gauge, and you had it read what you wanted it to believe, want it to read, and so, or you may have changed it when you took your photograph. But no, he took the gauge, and he passed the gauge along the piece of rock, and around in a 360 degree arc, and across that 360 degree arc, which was probably, I would say, a 16-inch 16-inch circle, that gauge, that dial indicator, didn't move hardly at all, less than 0.5 tenths of an inch, which is absolutely incredible.
Oh, it is remarkable.
It's a smoking gun. It's like, you know, going into a place in Egypt and finding the same thing, and it's a smoking gun, because there's absolutely no need for a building block to be that precise. You know, the interesting thing was that I was on a tour with a group of people in 2011, and I had this gauge, and so what I wanted to do was actually have a show and tell with the guests the night before. Mm-hmm. And so we met in the suite at the Ritz Hotel in La Paz, a very beautiful place to stay, you know. And the Ritz Hotel is a very nice hotel, 5-star hotel. But they had a glass table, and I was trying to teach the guests how to read verniers and inside micrometers, and then use the surface gauge. So we cleared everything off the table, and I had my tools on the table, right? And I took the indicator on this manufactured tabletop, which was made of glass, and I passed it from the center to the edge, and it displaced the indicator dial 0.7 tenths of an inch.
Jeez!
And this is on a modern manufactured item.
Yeah.
And so then the next day we're off to Bolivia, and we find it within less than 0.5 tenths of an inch. And 0.5 tenths of an inch is 1/5 the thickness of a human hair.
Well, is it possible, and let me get you on this, Brian, because you talked about the possibility of this calamity, which caused people to you know, get some temporary amnesia and people weren't around to pass on this information. Is it possible civilizations could be not 11,500 years ago, but maybe millions of years ago, as Michael Cremo believes?
I'm not, you know, I personally think that's pushing it too far, but I can easily see that there was a very advanced culture. Some call it Atlantis, which I think is a name. I don't believe in the concept of a continent sinking in the ocean, but of course, once the Ice Age ended, the sea level around the world rose by 350 feet, and that might be an oral tradition which has to be interpreted as poetry, not literally. So when they say that the continent sank, it might simply mean that the sea level rose. And one little point I wanted to make with Chris, though, is that I don't think of Pumapunku as a place. I think of it as a time period. And so that's why around Tiwanaku, you find things that are very similar to Pumapunku. But I think Pumapunku was the first site that occupied all of Tiwanaku, and then devastation happened, reclamation and recycling happened, and then a later culture came and built Tiwanaku there, because I found the exact same stones that you find in terms of precision at, that you find at Pumapunku scattered in piles, almost like refuse piles around Tiwanaku.
What are the names? Pumapunku.
That's a sensible idea, yeah.
Thanks.
What do the names mean, Brian?
Well, Pumapunku, puma, of course, is an animal. It's a large cat.
Yeah.
And punku means gate, so it's the gate of the puma. Tiwanaku is an Aymara word, and I'm actually not quite sure what the name means, because the problem is that that area of Lake Titicaca, it's a mix of the Aymara culture and the Quechua culture.
Now, Pumapunku is in ruins, unlike some of the other areas, right?
Oh, exactly. Like I say, there's maybe 5% of Pumapunku left, because if you visit the nearby village, you'll see even in the church, this very specific gray stone, which some people call diorite, but it's not a true diorite. You'll see that the people who built the church there in the 16th century built it out of Pumapunku stone, because you see these precision holes in it, the flat surfaces and things. So that's the very sad thing about Pumapunku, is that very little of it still exists. But even if we only had two pieces, both of those pieces show the precision that Chris has been talking about, which is astonishingly sophisticated.
Sure is. And what more needs to be investigated out there, Chris?
Well, there is quite a lot. You know, the like Brian said, there's a lot missing. There's a tremendous amount missing. But I think that when we go back in August, we're taking a group down in August to Peru and Bolivia. But I will be looking. I want to actually examine the church in Tiwanaku and look at the Pumapunku stones that made it there. When I went there in 2011, I was looking for evidence that these stones actually were interlocking or fitted together through an interlocking system, because of the way they have these geometric protrusions from the rock, and it looks like perhaps a protrusion on one rock would slide into a recess on another rock, and the other thing that I was looking for was manufacturing precision, where you would find that the dimensions of some of these geometric elements were the same from rock to rock. So that was the nature of my investigation in 2011. And what I found was I was astounded by it, and I was totally surprised, because most of the drawings are information that I had read about Puma Punku showed that the recesses on these famous H blocks now, I think they've become quite famous since Ancient Aliens, but these H blocks have these recesses in them, and they appear to be parallel, and they appear to be the same from one block to the next. And so when I went there in 2011, I took a range of instruments that would allow me to actually measure the dimensions from one block to the other to see if they were the same. And if they were, that would definitely speak to the use of manufacturing equipment, machines that would be consistent in creating the same kind of block. And also, there was another theory out there that these blocks were poured into molds. And so that was another part of the investigation, was to see if there was any merit to that idea. And my dimensions that I took on the inside of these recesses, I was able to examine four of these recesses. And what I found was that each one was different. And the interesting thing is, and what amazed me, was that the front of the opening of these recesses was smaller than the back. So they were actually like dovetails, where you have dimensions that are getting larger as you go deeper into the rock. That was quite a discovery for me, because it was like, well, why would they do such a thing?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they had to have done it intentionally. And then I started to inspect other parts of these blocks, and I found that there are other elements of the blocks that were not square either. So you would expect that if you had an orthogonal machine where the axes moved rectangular to each other or perpendicular to each other, that you would find squareness in the corners or along the surfaces from one surface to the other. And that's not the case in these H blocks, which was quite puzzling to me. So the only conclusion that I could come up with was that they were the dovetails were used to lock into place another piece. So there was another detail that was actually locked into place in these dovetails. Now, what could that be? That was the question. And like I was mentioning earlier, I try to connect and still my mind and put away all preconceived notions and try and connect with the ancients. And at 3 o'clock one morning, I woke up, and just in the half dream state, it came to me that they were actually hinge blocks, and that these recesses locked into place the hinges. And
like Legos, almost, huh?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, and then when you consider that the way we build hinges today, and the way we install them into buildings, we use screws and bolts and something with a thread that threads through into a piece of wood or something. But in the ancient times, the screw is a fairly modern invention, and it didn't, it wasn't prevalent in industrial use until the Industrial Revolution, and as far as being readily available in hardware stores. Well, there weren't any hardware stores, so that's a modern phenomenon. But the screw is relatively new. It's not just just over 100 years old. The Phillips screw wasn't invented until the 1950s.
Well, they had to improvise, Chris. We're going to come back and talk about elongated skulls and more on Egypt when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And, of course, our two special guests tonight, Christopher Dunn, Brian Forrester, will take your phone calls with them next hour when we come back. Elongated skulls, wait till you hear this on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Let's start with you, Brian, about these elongated skulls. Where are they on this planet?
Well, that's something that David Hatcher and David Hatcher Childress and I have been researching. He and I just published a book in February about the global phenomenon of cranial deformation, and that occurred in Iraq, in Egypt, in South America, amongst the Olmecs in Melanesia. It was a global phenomenon, most commonly about 1500 BC. And so what we tried to do with the book is to see if there were relationships between these different people. And what we found out was that that seemed to be the case, but predominantly it seemed to happen in Peru, and more specifically the area where I live, which is called Paracas. In Paracas specifically, these people died out at least 2,000 years ago. We have no idea how far back in time they go, and that presently is my research.
Okay, so now explain what these elongated skulls look like, Brian.
Okay, well, actually, most people have seen them on Ancient Aliens and other other TV shows,
right?
Suggesting that they're alien people, alien beings, or hybrid humans. So what they are is the head is distended, and I guess Dan Aykroyd came up with the term cone head. They're very cone head looking people. That's also the term that Lloyd Pye, who I'm working with, refers to them.
Okay, now, how did they make them elongated?
Well, the subject of the book with David was that this was done by deformation, which means that it was like a religious ritual practice by binding the skull from childhood to make them look as though they are eventually this cone head, appearance. But the more research I'm doing suggests that the cranial deformation is actually the latest phase, and that farther back in time, that there were natural people or people who naturally looked that way, because all the cultures that I've been studying in their oral traditions, they say that the reason why they would bind the skull of the children, and it was always the nobility, was because they wanted the child to look like the ancestors.
What about some kind of alien intervention theory from above?
Well, I come from a scientific background, but I am starting to lean towards that. I think, especially in Paracas, where we have these huge skulls, some of them, the average human being today is about, the cranial volume is about 1.2 liters.
Yeah.
And some of these are, and I've measured them, are 1.5 and 1.8 liters in size. So the brains themselves were larger, much larger than modern humans. Some people have suggested that, no, it's simply cranial manipulation and that there were air pockets inside of the skulls. But I've done analysis of actual skulls, and I've seen where the brain tissue touches the interior. So these ancient people did have brains which were much larger than ours are.
So are you tipping, Brian, to the possibility that they could have been influenced by ETs?
Yes, I am. And actually, working with Lloyd Pye, we're moving towards that. Again, coming from a scientific background, I don't like to speculate too much, but it is suggesting that the most ancient of these people were not necessarily human. And the DNA testing that we're doing is suggesting that as well, because we've done preliminary DNA testing. The same geneticist that is analyzing the Paracas skulls is the one who has been studying the Star Child. And he's he believes so far that, the thing is that he's doing it for free. And so the only way to keep him interested would be the fact that there are not human genomes in the DNA sequences, and that's what he's starting to find out. He's quite puzzled, and he's quite pleased. And I actually got an email from Lloyd about 2 hours ago saying that the geneticist definitely wants to continue testing in order to find out exactly who these people were or beings.
What's your take on this, Chris?
Well, I think it's definitely a fascinating subject. It's not my subject, but, you know, it's one that I have been close to with my friends like Brian and Lloyd and David. So I find it fascinating. I don't really have anything to add to the discussion, really. But it does, the mystery to me is that it's an unknown subject. I mean, the existence of these skulls, the history of them, that is the most fascinating to me.
It is. There's no doubt. But you know, you in the past, you haven't been too enthusiastic about the alien intervention theory. Are you changing?
Well, you know, here's my take on that. I think that there is a huge question mark regarding our origins and our history. And there are many different ideas and theories about the nature of ancient people and where they got this technology. I mean, there is a huge question mark. It does leave room for those kind of speculations, particularly when you find incredible accomplishments, the stonework and the precision, the geometry, and there's nothing in the historical record, the archaeological record, to explain it. So where did it come from? Now, as far as my involvement in the ancient aliens, it's like, I'm going to be speaking at the Yuga conference in near Sacramento at the end of May, and I know nothing about the Yugas, but they seem to be interested in my work and believe that it may add value to, you know, their particular understanding of that the cycle of the Yugas in terms of were the Egyptians at the same level as the Indians, or were the Indians at the same level as the Egyptians right. at that period in time. But as I said, I know nothing about the Yugas. I'm just there to present my data. And when people who are ancient alien believers want me to speak to them about what I found in Egypt and in Peru, I'm more than happy to do that. But my I still have that question mark in the back of my mind about the nature of ancient people, their ability to move or travel around the planet, the evidence that we see of artifacts that appear to resemble modern astronauts, mm-hmm. and you know, on the one side you could say that they were extraterrestrials. They were not from this planet. They came to this planet with their technology. And people, the indigenous people of the air at the time, crafted these effigies to them. And, there's a lot of strong support for that. And, you know, in the back of my mind, I think that, you know, well, we're taking modern icons of space travel, such as, you know, the astronaut in the helmet. But they were terrestrial developments, not extraterrestrial developments. So, you know, the question in my mind is, could it be that, they did have space flight? They were a spacefaring civilization. But was the technology developed on this planet and not off this planet? So I think those two questions are valid. I lean more towards the terrestrial development rather than the extraterrestrial development. But you know that, George. We've talked many times
yes.
about that. And the ancient aliens folks know that too. So, I mean, but, you know, I'm quite happy to talk to anybody, you know, regardless of what their beliefs are.
Christopher, what's new in the world of Egypt? Anything out there that you've been studying?
Well, George, there has been some exciting developments, particularly for my work, if you want to talk about that briefly.
Yeah, please.
As you recall, there was a lot of excitement in 2002 leading up to an exploration that was broadcast live across the planet, and it garnered about 30 million viewers in the U.S., and it was opening of the Lost Tombs live with Zahi Hawass, where they went up the southern shaft of the Queen's Chamber, drilled a hole in the famous Ganton Brinks door, which is really a small limestone plate at the end of an 18-inch square shaft, and poked a camera behind there and came up with very little.
Yes.
So it was kind of like an anticlimax, right?
It was a little like Al Capone's vault.
It seemed to be, yeah. Where's the mummy? There wasn't one. And there wasn't much of anything else. But as you recall, I went out there and I predicted that they would find a continuation of the copper, or if it is copper, nobody knows if it's copper, but the copper fittings or metal fittings that protruded through that limestone block. And that, according to the Giza power plant theory, they were used as electrodes.
Yes.
And so it was. I think we talked right before the show aired about what may be found behind Ganton Brink's door when they finally penetrated it. Well, that was a quite widely broadcast and promoted. But interestingly enough, very quietly, at the beginning of the next year, and perhaps it was because Zahi Hawass didn't want to gather too much attention or gain too much attention to himself because of some of the political problems that were developing in the country, as you recall, the Arab Spring.
Sure.
But in January, a new team actually built another robot and went up that shaft. And the camera that they poked through the hole was able to wrap around or turn around and look back on the back of the limestone block or the Ganton Brinks door that it's been named. And some images were captured, and they were published online on the New Scientist website. And they're very, very interesting. These copper fittings or metal fittings actually turn, they loop, and it appears that they go back into the block. And then there are some faint indications that there may be a cable coming from the top at the center of this block. So the other fascinating discovery that they made was these glyphs that were painted on the floor behind the Ganton Brinks door. And these glyphs, they are not hieroglyphs, and there has been no... when they first saw them, nobody knew what they were. And I think in the final analysis, they said that they were Mason's marks. And so we have these marks. There are three symbols and a line painted on the floor behind Ganton Brink's door. The center of the symbols shows a circle and a vertical line with two lines coming out like a stick figure, except without arms. Both sides of that symbol, that figure, there is another figure, but it looks like a number 5. And one it looks distinctly like a number 5. The other one, it's not as clear, but it looks like when it was originally painted, it could have been the number 5 also. So
how did somebody get in there? Isn't that small?
Well, it gets better because when you consider the design of these metal fittings or electrodes, as I describe them, it became obvious to me that they were actually designed so that they could be replaced. And when you look at the original Ganton Brink video, when they finally discovered those metal fittings, they were quite eroded, and one had actually broken off and was lying in the passage or in the shaft. So According to the Giza power plant theory, there would have been a corrosive chemical in the shaft, and it's quite likely that those metal fittings would have eroded over time and use, and eventually they would have had to have been replaced. And so the design of the Gantenbrink's door now is such that you could actually take those out and replace them with new ones.
That is
now, there's an article on my website that you can link to from the front page on the new exploration of the southern shaft in the Queen's Chamber. But I actually created a design that showed what those symbols mean and what the electrodes mean as far as their design, their use, and the symbols on the floor were nothing more than electronic symbols that showed people who came after how this machine was wired.
It's like a schematic almost, huh?
It's a schematic, absolutely. And the center figure is actually a cable. It shows a cable with a twisted pair coming out of it, quite clearly. The two figures on the side, the number five, those were connectors, and they connected with the metal fittings in the door, and then they attached to a central cable. And so now we have pretty much all the elements of how that piece of equipment functioned. And you might be interested to know that Ancient Aliens visited me a few weeks ago, and I demonstrated a model of the upper portion of the shaft with the Gantenbrink's door and the whole thing functioning as it was described in the Giza power plant.
As the years have gone by, Christopher, more convinced than ever that the Giza pyramids indeed power plants?
Yes, I am more convinced. I've always, until such time that somebody comes along and can explain everything that I've put in that book in terms of the evidence and how it fits cohesively and coherently in the theory, nobody has been able to do that yet. And then if they can predict how a thing functions or what may be found through further exploration, then and it turns out to be different, then of course I would have to go back to the drawing board or disappear off the planet, one or the other.
Don't disappear on us.
But so far, everything that has been tested and everything that has been found actually supports the theory, which is remarkable. John Cadman, who I believe you know of, he proved that the subterranean chamber actually functioned like a pulse generator, which is what I described in the Giza power plant, that the priming pulses to bring the pyramid into resonance with the planet was started in the subchamber, and an engineer in Bellingham, Washington, actually demonstrated that.
All amazing stories, Christopher. We're going to come back with more phone calls on Coast to Coast AM.